This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, we have two sponsors for the show, our friends at Aerohive and Jam Software. We'll tell you a lot more about both of those technology solutions, which work great together, later on in the show. So, Bradley, how are you?
I am knee-deep in MacBook Air firmware recall.
Oh, good times, good times.
I counted, I got 65 to test, and... Mm-hmm. So Apple this week changed kind of their process. I now have the option as like a self-servicing school to actually get paid for testing it, which is pretty cool because otherwise we're just like spending money, my labor money. But I have to like all the ones I've tested so far, I have to go back and redo so it kind of pings that information back to Apple's back-end systems.
Okay.
So far I've got 10 that... You know, you've got three options on the just to clarify, these are the mid 2012... So they were sold in like September of 2012 to June of 2013. MacBook Airs with 64 or 128 gig flash memory that they, in certain situations, can develop data loss. I guess the drive crashes. So one of three things can happen. Your computer isn't affected. Your computer is affected and a firmware upgrade will fix it. Or number three, you have to actually have the flash memory swapped out. It's all covered under a recall warranty. So even if it's like out of warranty, you're still good. So like the process, you know, for regular consumers is it tests it through software update and tells you, you know, you're good or no. For schools like us, we have to boot into what's called Apple Software Toolkit. It's like a NetBoot server that you run on a, you know, Mavericks, Mountain Lion, or Lion server. And Apple Software Toolkit, or it's called AST, is actually replaces some old tools from Apple where you had to, like, how you would actually test hardware to tell you exactly what was wrong. Like, if it's like detecting the Bluetooth card or it's not. And it helps you determine if something is hardware and software. And so, they added a piece on Friday that actually will test and repair a flash storage test. And so I've got a block of 10 11-inch Airs that I've gone through seven of them, and all of them are option number two, which is it needs the fix, but the firmware fixes it. What's funny is it says that it's going to have to wipe the drive. And so what I do is I have a Thunderbolt dock with a small SSD that is basically 64 gigs, so I can clone the drive. So I'm cloning each drive ahead of time, but it's not having to actually wipe it, so that's good. So so far, I'm doing good. I have probably done a total of 15, but I have 65 to do, so long way to go.
And it's always getting your hands on them as well, because those are in the hands of teachers, right?
Exactly. And so our technology teacher, she works 4 days a week. She is like what we consider to be 80%. So she only works 4 days a week. So I will probably try to take control of our majority of our student laptops that are affected on one of those days. And I can probably knock them out. But yeah, it's like I go to a teacher and I say, hey, can I borrow your laptop? And then it's like, you know, I need it for 30 minutes and she's about to use it to do something. So it's difficult, but we have to do it. So, but yeah, I mean, we stand to make a little bit of money. So that's actually kind of nice. Better than nothing.
Yes, indeed. I've been having a bit of a hard time with Apple Configurator this week.
Yeah, your tweets, it's just strange. I talk to people that have no issues, and I talk to people that have all kinds. And you just wonder, is it like something about the configuration, like the USB hub you're using, the type of your computer you're using? I don't know. Like I have not had issues in probably a year with it.
Yeah, I just don't know is the problem. And I think, you know, we've been seeing various things like when you connect. This morning I connected 14 devices, and when I came back to it, three of them were reset to the default iOS setup assistant for some reason, and the rest were fine. You know, they were getting the 703 update at the time. So very confusing, very random. Haven't got to the bottom of it at all, but trying to recover the situation. Fortunately, I do have iTunes backups of all of them, but trying to get iTunes and Configurator to play nice together to actually get the backup up and running on a device is pretty difficult as well.
I guess this is like hashtag first world problems, but it's still frustrating. Because it's never a convenient time to have an iTunes or an iPad be set back to factory default. There's just never a good day for that.
No, there isn't. Unfortunately, these are iPads that stay in school overnight, so I can go in after hours and spend some time working on them. But Yeah, frustrating. Frustrating time. Hopefully we'll get to the bottom of it sooner or later. I will report when we do.
Yeah, next year maybe. let's take a moment and thank our first sponsor for the day. Yeah. We'll get started. Jamp Software, been with us for a while now. Jamp provides IT staff with enterprise tools that power Apple technologies, includes Macs, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs and education organizations. You know, this is a company that's focused on Apple. They treat Apple as first-class citizens. It's not an add-on that, you know, Apple features come last. That is their focus. So I got a great technology called Casper Focus that allows teachers to actually take control of the classroom using their iPads. So this is not something that's for IT staff. This is actually a very, very simple technology that allows the teachers to quickly gain their students' attention. They can conduct secure exams. They can even select certain Apple TVs. They can choose and distribute iBooks. And they can even initiate Apple AirPlay right from within their own iPad. So basically, it's on their own teacher's iPad and allows them to take control of the student's iPad. On a technical level, this is using the Guided Access API, but they've implemented it in a really cool way. So if you're looking for mobile device management for your organization, again, that can be laptops, desktops, iPads, iPhones, and even Apple TVs, you definitely want to check out Jamf Software. It's jamfsoftware.com, and thanks for them for sponsoring the show this week.
Still haven't put my Apple TVs under NDM control.
I got a fourth Apple TV. We're like an Apple TV house now, and I feel like we're living in the future because I got a fourth Apple TV, and we have an antenna. We get over the air. Yeah, well, it's funny. We have like regular cable at home, like channel 2 through 13, because it's like the internet's the same. Mm-hmm. It's like the same overall bill whether you get the TV or not, because they just give you the bundle discount on the internet.
Yeah,
and you know, we don't get high def though, and we get all our high def stuff through Apple TV. And so we decided to buy an antenna. And it's funny when you go to Walmart or Best Buy and you're looking at these antennas, and they're like marketing it specifically at people that are cord cutters and talking about how it's a great addition to your, you know, streaming services. It's very interesting how they're positioning themselves. Like, it's kind of like they're like, hey, this is, you get your high def locals, local channels, but then you have your streaming services too. So kind of interesting.
That's interesting to hear that that's hitting the mainstream stores. I mean, that surprises me, but interesting to hear.
Yeah, and this was like, the one I read this on was at like Walmart, and it was the RCA brand, which is not even like kind of a high-end brand.
Yeah.
And we pick up all the major locals but ABC, but I've got another antenna on the way that's amplified that should rectify that. We just got some trees near us, but yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, cool. So I want to boast a little bit. I have on my desk here an iPad Air.
I hate you.
It is amazing. That's the first thing to say. It is one of the most amazing things I've ever had. It's light, but more than light and thinner, it is so fast. It is ridiculously fast. And I guess that's the first thing it's the first thing that hits me more than the thinness and the lightness I can live with. You know, I wasn't that upset about the way my third generation was, but the performance is just off the charts. It's amazing.
I was just checking mine. It's still sitting in processing.
Processing.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. So
what size did you order?
32 gig Wi-Fi, 32 with, Wi-Fi. With a black case. And so
I went to 128 this time.
Ah, nice. So did you have any problems getting it like that day? You just walk in the store and...
Just walk in the store and get it, yep. It was, like I said before, that was the one that, you know, obviously being the most expensive iPad, it's also the one that probably has the least demand, but didn't have any problem. I went for a white one with a red iPad Air smart cover, which I do not love at all, as much as I love the device. We'll talk about that in a minute, perhaps, but... Yeah, just completely delighted with it. I mean, I think that when you use an iPad as much as I do, then you're so attuned to every little thing that's slow about it. And certainly coming from a third generation, there was plenty that was slow. But in particular, it's just all those small things that shouldn't be slow but were. You know, things like how long does it take you to go from the home screen to being able to type in a search into the App Store? right? That's always something that's been a wee bit janky on older iPads. You launch the App Store, got to wait for it all to load all that stuff, and then you can tap the search field, and then the keyboard takes a wee minute to come up, and then you can type. This thing is just, you know, tap, tap, done. And if, I'm sure it's actually faster than I've got into my head that it's as fast, if you know what I mean. Like, I'm waiting for it when I don't need to wait for it. That's how fast it is, and it's really, really, really impressive.
What are you using storage wise? Like, I'm assuming you've loaded it up at this point. Like, how much of the space are you using?
I can tell you for definite, but I'm certainly not using all of it yet. Let's see, there's 115 and 84 gigs are still available. So I'm using about 30 gigs so far. I have not synced any photos onto it yet, nor have I synced any videos or downloaded any videos from the iTunes store. But I have loaded up a few additional games to try, and just as a sort of performance test as well. That's been quite interesting. So a lot of the reasoning for going for a 128 was because I use it to record videos in school, and I want to do more of that, and I want to not have to, because when I was doing that with my 64, I was having to like save all the videos off to Dropbox and then bring them back two at a time to put together an iMovie and then export that back again, doing a lot of shuffling about. So I just wanted to have a lot of free space to work in when I wanted to do iMovie projects and things like that. And I think the reason behind that as well is that because of this additional performance, it's actually not just possible but enjoyable to do those kind of projects on the iPad now, whereas before you might have tried to get the videos off and into Final Cut on the Mac or something just because it would be faster on the Mac. It's actually smooth and pleasant to do it on the iPad as well.
How does it feel? I mean, like, you had a mini and a third gen. Like, how does it feel in your hand?
Well, I think I would echo what some of the other reviewers have said, which is that it feels closer to the mini than it does to the previous generation iPad. And I think on the scales, that's actually true as well, that it is actually closer. It's more mini-like. I think it's slightly interesting because the side bezels are narrower. When you're typing on it, you have to sort of adjust your muscle memory a little bit because things are just a wee bit further away or nearer than they have been before. So that's a wee bit of adjustment that had to be done, but not difficult at all. And holding it in one hand is great. I was kind of concerned about the thin bezels on the left and right-hand sides. I was concerned about that on the bigger iPad because I thought, well, if it weighs more, then you need to have more space for leverage with your thumb to hold it in place. But because they've reduced the weight so much, it's not a problem at all to hold. And even just a kind of thin grip on the left-hand side where you've got your thumb sort of just halfway on the device and halfway off, that feels perfectly secure because you've not got this heavy weight counterbalancing your grip. So it's really nice in that respect too, to sit and hold. It's funny though, because the bezel's not even all the way around, it feels like a widescreen tablet, but it doesn't have a widescreen display. It's kind of funny that way, because it is clearly now more wider than it is tall than it was before. You kind of think that it's going to have a widescreen aspect, and it sort of almost looks like it does, but it actually doesn't. Does that even make any sense? I don't know if that makes sense, but I love the way it feels. I think it's great in the hand. It's a great device for reading on now as well. Doesn't get as warm as the third gen iPad did. I always had that little sort of warm spot in the lower left on the back where I guess that's where the GPU was in the Retina iPad. But no, really, really happy with it. Very impressed also with the effect of MIMO on the Wi-Fi as well. I've noticed probably about a 10 megabits per second difference between what my iPhone can get and what the iPad can get on the same home broadband connection. So that's a nice little boost as well.
Yeah, I remember reading your tweets after you got it, and when you were editing last week's podcast, I'm assuming, the drastic difference and just the time it took.
I did a little test with that. So we have in the past used Aria, which is an iOS app, to record the podcast and edit it and mix it and export it. And when I was doing that before, like the episode from Chicago, I think it was, I still had that on my old iPad, so I transferred the project from one device to the other, and then I timed both of them to do the mix down and conversion to MP3. And now, I think Aria could probably be faster at this. I think there's probably some less than optimally efficient code in that app, because just strikes me that it should not take that length of time to do this. But what I saw was that the third generation iPad took basically 57 minutes to do a 62-minute file. So it's only fractionally better than real-time encoding into MP3. For the same project with all the same settings, the iPad Air did it in 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of difference we're talking about. And that turns that kind of exercise from, I can do this and it will work, but it's tenuous, it's going to chew my battery because it's running for an hour, and if it doesn't work or if it fails, then I've got another hour to sit until it succeeds. And I suppose really I was doing that partly just to prove that I could do it, whereas on the iPad Air, I'm doing it now because it's something that, you know, makes sense and is easy to do. Now, a 15-minute operation is not nothing, and it's not instantaneous by any means, but it's certainly much less, you know, ridiculously time-consuming and a lot of babysitting work than it was on the older iPad.
Go ahead. Yeah, you know, again, if it was 57 to 40, that's one thing, but 57 to 15, that's kind of absurdly different.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of lines up, I suppose. It's sort of a 4x improvement, if you like. And given that I was working on a third-generation iPad and not a fourth-generation iPad, that's, you know, the fourth gen is twice as fast, and then this one's twice as fast again. That seems like what you should sort of expect, but you're not quite prepared for just how wildly divergent those two performance numbers are in the real world. And I was sitting there with a stopwatch trying to be really sort of scientific about it. There's no point in being scientific about it. You could tell by the fact that, you know, 45 minutes later, the other one still hasn't quite finished.
Mine is preparing for shipment, but it's been saying that for a couple of days. That makes me sad. I am, I've had the Mini ever since it came out, so I guess about a year now, and I really have started to miss the Retina display. And so, I mean, can you tell a difference in, say, your third gen display to the fifth gen?
Not terribly. The displays seem very similar to my eyes. I haven't noticed really any difference in responsiveness or the colors or anything like that. It seems to be as good as it ever was, basically, and always was pretty good. So that was, I'm perfectly happy with that. One thing that is quite interesting, though, is that, you know, the iPad Mini's always been a great iPad for games because it's obviously so light to hold, yet you've got quite a large screen to work on. And one of the things I can say about the iPad Air is that it is equally satisfying to play games on because it is perfectly holdable for that kind of length of time. And if you like, my favorite kind of games are driving games, so things like Need for Speed, Most Wanted, and Real Racing and things like that. And playing those type of games on the full-size iPad is fantastic. It's a real treat for the eyes. And because a lot of the developers bump up the detail and the quality on the games when they're on a faster device as well, really, really looks great.
Well, I'll be interested to get one maybe sometime. I don't know. So what about the case do you not like?
Well, because the left and right bezels are thinner in vertical orientation, what they've done is they've taken this... I got this smart cover, the one without the back, and what they've done is they've taken it down from 4 segments on the full-size iPad to 3. And that's the way the iPad Mini has been. So what happens is that the outside edge of the case kind of makes a T-shape with the inside edge of the case, so that there's no overlapping panel the way there is with the 4-section cover. And what I find with it is that the magnetic connection between those two parts of the case is not strong enough to be handled when it's closed. And what I mean by that is that if you even just fractionally bump the case when you're moving it around, it will flop apart and you've got to reassemble it again. And I find that really annoying because it seems to happen like, you know, if you roll the case up and then you set it on a desk, it's fine. But say you're sitting with it on your lap and you lift the iPad up and put it on the arm of the sofa, the chances are by the time you pick it up again, it will have somehow come undone. So I think I bought it because obviously on day one you need to buy whatever Apple's got ready beforehand. But I'm looking forward to replacing it with something that I like more. But I've never found an iPad case that I actually like all that much. So I just assume that I'm going to continue to be as frustrated as I've always been with that.
Yeah, I'm doing a little side project for a local restaurant franchise here in town. About like I mentioned it before, on using Evernote for business, and the maintenance guys like doing their repairs and processing them through Evernote, which it's going really well. I got signed up for Evernote for business, and it's actually really, really nice. So the company ordered some refurbished 4th-gen iPads because they were $379, which is a really nice deal. Mm-hmm. And that's really all they need. A 4th-gen iPad 2 would have probably been fine, but the 4th-gen will get them a better camera. And then they ordered two different kind of cases that had keyboards built in. And like one's a Belkin and one's a Logitech. And both are fine. But then I just think, you know, some of these, like that sounds good in principle that the keyboard's built in, but there's so many times when I'm not typing on it, and I am just reading. Yeah. And so that's why I think like something, even Logitech's like just keyboard cover is not really something that I would want. I almost think like using just a standalone Bluetooth keyboard then with some sort of, you know, case that can make a stand would be the mm-hmm. way to go.
Yeah, no, I've used that for quite a long time now, the Origami Workstation by InCase, which is just a folding sheet, if you like, that has clips shaped for the back, the sort of curled back part of the Apple Bluetooth keyboard. And that folds into a kind of origami stand that you can put the iPad in. And I've used that for years, and I still have it, and it works great whenever you change the form factor of your device, because it doesn't depend on the form factor of the device, unlike many of these other cases and clip-on keyboards and so on that assume the shape of the device. So I've stuck with that. I don't use it that much, but I like you, I prefer to take the keyboard with me when I know I'm going to need a keyboard, rather than just in case I might want a keyboard at some point. Because I'm pretty good with the virtual keyboard. Not as fast as with a plastic keyboard, but I think the times that I want to sit down and bang out a lot of text on the iPad, I probably know that in advance. Now, whether I'm taking a big train trip or I'm going on a plane or something, the one time I will take an iPad keyboard with me is if I'm traveling on business and I'm only going iPad, then I'll take the keyboard along with me just in my suitcase in case I want it when I'm there, maybe to do a lot of emails or something like that, or to write a blog post or whatever. I wanted to just mention one thing. You know, this thing about performance in the iPad, I think this is, I mean, I said on Twitter, like, I'm not going to shut up about this for a couple of months, so you might want to unfollow me right now. But to my mind, this iPad is, it takes the iPad into another realm of productivity. And what I mean by that is that there were things that I could, I mean, it runs the same software, right? There were things I could do on my third generation iPad that I can do on this one. But they just weren't fast enough to be either comfortable or enjoyable. And I don't mean just things like Aria, where it sits an hour exporting an MP3, but even things like I want to go into a complex website. You know, maybe I want to go into my Aerohive dashboard and change something about my network. Okay, that's a complex web page, a lot of rendering to be done. And previously, I would have gone to my Mac and done that just because it was sluggish or slow or whatever. And now, like today in school, for example, I just worked the whole day and I never even took my laptop out of its case. It sat in my bag the whole day because things I did, you know, I was remote desktoping into computers all over the school. I was sending documents to kids over AirDrop, gathering documents in, surfing the web, looking up things about my Apple configurator issues, sending emails. And I just did all of it from the iPad Air because it was sufficiently smooth and fast that it didn't get in my way for any of those tasks. I think that's a really important threshold to have gotten over. And of course, developers will eat up that benefit in time. But for now, it's those things that stand out. Two big things that stand out for me. The time taken for apps to become ready to be interacted with after you've either switched back to them or launched them from cold. That's one thing that's really, really, really improved in the iPad Air. And the second one is rendering complex web pages in Safari. So the sarcastic line that somebody used on Twitter the other day was, this is the first iPad where The Verge actually renders in real time. It was pretty sluggish on previous devices. But to my mind, it's just the smoothness of multitasking now is really, really impressive. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, you know, what tasks actually force me back to the Mac now to get them done efficiently or fast. And I think what the iPad Air has done is it's taken another chunk out of that story. So now it's only the really big things that are requiring the Mac, certainly.
Like Word.
Like Word. Yeah, that yes. thing that everybody needs to do a job.
PowerPoint, you can't do that on the iPad. Who are we kidding?
Nah. Everybody loves that yellow text on a blue background.
Or I love the Outlook with the cloudy background. Outlook emails. It's like makes me cringe. Or like the fancy signatures with the long quotes. Like people aren't reading those, folks. Just don't do it. Simple signatures.
Please consider the environment before printing this email.
Yeah, who prints an email? It's people. Please
consider the environment before being an old person.
Yeah.
Sorry, old people.
I had a conversation with an employee yesterday talking about Gmail. She was saying that, like, she's like, I have all these emails in my inbox, and it gets on my nerves, but I don't, like, if I put them somewhere, like, if I put them, like, you know, archive them and put them to a label, I'll forget to look at them. But it annoys me that they're still in my inbox. And I looked at her, and I said, what do you want me to do? So I said, I don't mean this the wrong way, but it sounds like you want your cake, and you want to eat it, too. And I said, you either have to, like, deal with it being in the inbox, or, like, make a calendar appointment to check a label every Monday. It's like,
well, you just leave them in the inbox until you get frustrated with them, and then you just make a new email address.
Yeah, good call. Well, it's corporately, I don't think that would work. So, I'll be interested to get my iPad. I am, you know, again, I got 32 gig black with a black smart case, not a cover. So, We shall see. I called Apple last night, and of course, I ordered direct through the education store, and so their allocations are different. So, like, even though it says shipping immediately on the regular consumer store, it's just the allocations are different. So, hopefully, mine will ship this week. That's my goal. So,
I think it's also interesting to consider that the iPad Mini now has exactly this level of performance.
Yes,
and I think that's huge as well. Is that the Mini? In some ways, people sort of might have thought of that as a lesser iPad because it wasn't as fast as the fourth generation iPad. But now I think both of them absolutely deserve to be considered on an equal basis. And the real benefit is, really just, do I like a small size? Do I like a big size? Which one fits me better? And there's nothing to be gained or lost by going one way or the other in terms of performance or availability of storage sizes, or Wi-Fi, or VR versus 3G, or anything like that. They're technically the same, and it's really just a matter of choice. And I think that's really exciting.
They could have made the Mini the same specs as the iPad 4, fourth generation, and we would have all probably been okay with that. And just had recognized, well, it's a small device, I can't shrink the A7 enough, but it's pretty amazing that they did that.
Yeah, and I think many people have already said that the fact that the iPad Mini is not actually shipping yet suggests that it's been very tight in terms of a go decision about whether or not that could be achieved. So we'll see when that comes out, but I certainly expect that. And it's exciting for the platform, I think, that all the new devices that are going to be bought this Christmas, plus or minus a few people buying non-Retina Minis probably for their kids, that they're all going to have that level of performance. iPhone 5S, which some people are saying now is the best-selling iPhone, all the iPads, apart from the legacy models, are all A7 class. And I think that's really, that bodes well for the platform in the future, because I'm interested to see what developers can do with this.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's, if your iPads don't have apps, then there's only so many things you can do with, the built-in things. I mean, that really the secret sauce is what you can do connecting to other services, other experiences.
That's exactly the truth.
So, why don't we take a moment to thank our next sponsor? Last one for the day, Arrowhive Networks. Mm-hmm. Actually had a school in today that is a Cisco school, and they are two APs away from maxing out their controller. And so they are looking to switch. So they came by to check out Hive Manager and check out some of the access points. And so they were highly impressed. So what does Arrowhive do? They reduce the cost and complexity of today's networks with cloud-managed Wi-Fi switching and routing solutions for enterprise and medium-sized companies. Have options for branch offices and remote workers as well. Arrowhive's award-winning cooperative control architecture eliminates the need for costly controllers and eliminates single points of failures. You can do either a public or private cloud, so you can either use their hosted service or you can run their software on your own VMware appliance. It doesn't matter either way, still the same product, still the same speed, everything's the same. What this does is it gives customers mission critical reliability with granular security and policy enforcement, and you have the ability to start small and expand up without limitations. So if you want to start out with 5 access points and grow from there, you can do that. If you want to start out with 100 and grow to 150, you can do that. Keep adding access points, you can keep adding switches. There is no limit, simply because there is no controller. They're building their networks the way the internet is built, so it's all distributed. So if you're an Aerohive customer, you will definitely want to check out Hive Nation. It's their online community portal. It's at community.aerohive.com. It's built on top of Git Satisfaction, if you've ever used that. So it's a pretty cool place. If you have questions, have an idea, it's a pretty cool place to go. Again, that's community.aerohive.com. And learn more about Aerohive, check out aerohive.com, AEROHIVE.com. And if you're in the market for a wireless solution, you can sign up for a webinar and as long as you qualify, there's some qualifications, you can get a free access point. So it's aerohive.com. We'll have links to both Jamf and Aerohive in the show notes.
Sweet. So, server side. Let's talk server side for a little minute. I'm going to throw in a really quick one. I set up a Maverick server today for a caching server. It seems to be working a treat in the school, which is great.
Nice.
For those of you who are not familiar with what this is, caching server has been a part of Mountain Lion server since it was released, and it was designed to cache Mac App Store apps and Apple software updates to make them available faster on your local network. Caching server 2 adds support for iOS, so it will cache iOS apps. It will also cache iBooks, I believe, as well, but I haven't used that yet. But it required iOS 7 on the client in order for the client to be redirected to your local cache instead of Apple. So I had a little test with it today, set it up about lunchtime, and did things. You know, I deleted and then re-downloaded GarageBand, and there's a little chart you can see in the server app that shows you how many bytes have been served through the caching server, both from the internet and from the local cache. And what I could see, because GarageBand's, 650 megs or something, I could see clearly there was a 650 meg spike where I downloaded the first version, and that all came from the internet, and then I deleted it and downloaded it again, and I could see these spikes were coming out of the cache instead. So it seems to be saving some bandwidth already, and that will only obviously grow as the cache warms up. But it was trivial to set up. I mean, you install Mavericks, install server, you click one switch that says go, and then you start downloading some iOS apps, and it seems to work. So far recommended. Somebody tweeted me after I mentioned it and said that it only caches free iOS apps. I'm not sure that's true, because I'm sure I re-downloaded a couple of other apps, one of which was FIFA 13, which I think is not a free application, and I'm pretty sure it cached that as well. So a little more testing on that just to verify, but it would be interesting to see if that was true or not.
It doesn't seem like it would be, because even free apps are still licensed to the Apple ID.
Yeah, they're still signed, aren't they?
Yes. So, like, if I downloaded a free app on my Mac and sent it, like an iPad app, and sent it to you, it would still ask you for your Apple ID when you tried to sync it. And so, yeah, I don't think from a functionality standpoint it matters.
Yeah, I'll check it again. I've got a reasonable test in my hands, which is the Call of Duty app. Forget what it's called again. Call of Duty Strike Team, which is a paid application and is 1.5 gigabytes, so it should show up quite nicely on the stats. I will double check that and see if I can find out the truth. That was just a throw in there just to let you know that was going on. But the big news for the things we do with iOS this week was the advent of this thing called Managed Distribution on the volume purchase program. I think we should talk about this a little bit.
Yes, I actually finally got an email about it today from Apple.
Oh, really? I have not seen that myself yet.
Yeah, I wonder if they're coming out in stages or whatnot, but I got it today. Probably. It was basically kind of a quick highlight with directing me to the internet to read more.
Mm-hmm. And there is a knowledge base article about this. I believe it's 6015, yes. Sorry. Is there any other information apart from that, or is that where they sent you?
Yeah, I think that's where they sent me, because I clicked on it and I didn't. The page looked the same, but I didn't actually check the URL. And we'll have it. There it is. It's in the Gmail. Even though it's like I deleted it and it was like in the Gmail trash and it said this message has no content. That stuff like that just like gives me the rage. And it's like no, it's actually sending me to apple.com/education/IT/VPP, and we'll have a link to that site. And the knowledge base article in the show notes. Yeah, it looks like it's a little different. I know my interface changed quite a bit, and so that was interesting.
Your interface in the volume purchase?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like it's already changed, and now I have the option to pick what kind of purchase I want to make, so it changed really quickly.
It's also changed in the UK store as well, so I've seen the same thing. And basically, I mean, let's lay out what we think this is, right? Streamlined distribution, it's being called. Or managed distribution, depending. So managed distribution is the idea that, put it this way. In the past, you bought a bunch of coupon codes and they were downloaded to you as an Excel spreadsheet. The problem of what you do with those coupon codes then was either one of two ways. In what Apple have called the institutional model, you would load a copy of the app and all the codes into Apple Configurator. And then you would distribute those apps to the individual devices over USB. In the personal model, which is what we're doing at Cedars for our secondary kids, we would load those coupon codes into our MDM server, Casper Suite, and then the kids would be able to request those apps to be pushed to their devices through Casper's self-service feature. The difference being that with Apple Configurator, you can deploy an app, and then you can recall it from the device again, and then you get credited back with the license. Whereas with the personal model, pushing those codes out through Casper, those codes are redeemed in the individual's Apple ID, and I can never get them back again. So that cost is sunk into that student, and we can't get it back. What this managed distribution model claims to do for you is allow you to have all that good stuff in terms of pushing it out remotely, not having to get the devices back to plug them in over USB, but then at the end of a period, you can retain the ownership of those apps and then redistribute them to other people in the future. That's quite a big deal.
That's a drastic change and something I never thought we'd see.
I didn't either. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the first of all the platforms, this is the first thing that allows content reallocation over the air. And by reallocation, I mean the ability to take one purchase and give it to one user for a while, take it back and give it to someone else. Because I'm pretty sure that the Google Play Store for Education doesn't allow that. It's first purchase only. And I'm pretty sure also Amazon's WhisperCast service for their Kindles is also the same. So you can buy a book and push it out, but you can never get it back. And I think this managed distribution thing is the first time any major platform vendor has done this in a way that kind of scales up again beyond having to get your hands back on the device and plug them in over USB to Apple Configurator. So this is another big step in terms of future scalability of large iOS deployments.
Yeah, and this is really exactly what we've been wanting in the bookstore, is the ability to do this with textbooks, give them and take them back. And so maybe over time we'll get there with books as well.
Yeah, that's one important thing to point out, is that this redistribution is only for apps. Now, you can buy codes for books and distribute them through the same channel, but the first allocation of a book code is permanent, whereas for an app, you can take it back. So that's a difference as well. But yeah, I think this is a big deal. Now, important thing to say is that the interface to administering this whole program is, in fact, your MDM server, not the volume purchase portal or the iTunes store or something like that. You have to have in place an MDM solution in order to be able to connect individual Apple IDs with your list of licenses that you've got purchased from the store and then send them, connect the two together. So, I mean, Bradley, we've been saying for a while that MDM is becoming a sort of core competency of one-to-one iPad deployments. And frankly, this is why we were saying it, is because this was coming. But for other reasons too. But this is, to me, this is the one thing that, you know, now if you were deploying a one-to-one iPad program and you were not planning to use an MDM server, I would probably say you were crackers.
No, I agree.
Yeah. So MDM, really, really important. What else is there to say about this new model?
Migration process.
Migration process. That's a big one, yeah. Because there's some... Obviously, there are some schools who have spent quite a lot of money already in the previous system with the codes. So the question then is that money all gone? Can you bring some of that investment over into this managed distribution world? And the answer is yes, some of it, but it depends what you've done with those codes in the meantime. So what it says on the Apple Knowledge Base page, let me just read it just for precision. It says, under the heading Migrating Redemption Codes to Managed Distribution, it says, if you previously purchased redemption codes through VPP, you can request to migrate these codes for use with managed distribution if the codes are unredeemed or were redeemed through Apple Configurator. Previously purchased redemption codes that have been redeemed by users can't be migrated. Okay, so what that's saying is that basically, if you already thought you were giving away those codes for good, they're still gone. So in the case of our school, the codes that our kids have redeemed through the Casper self-service portal, where they've got a coupon code for Pages or Keynote, and they've redeemed that, I can't get that back again, right? But for all the younger kids whose codes have been redeemed through Apple Configurator, or for any that I've got lying about that haven't been redeemed by anybody in either way, I can migrate all of those to this managed volume purchase program or managed distribution program. Now, it's a bit of an all or nothing thing as far as I can tell. Am I right?
Yeah, I've not seen anything to indicate otherwise.
I think it is. So it says here, consider the following if you decide, before you decide if migrating will work for your organization. Two bullet points here. One, make sure you want all your unredeemed codes redeemed or codes redeemed through Configurator converted to managed distribution before you request migration. If you choose migration, all previously purchased codes must be migrated and all unredeemed codes will be disabled after you convert to managed distribution. If you have unredeemed codes in circulation, you may want to redeem them, alert users they won't be available, or delay migration until they have been redeemed. Okay, so basically what they're saying is the Apple knows which codes they gave you. Once you request migration, all those codes are no longer going to work. So if you had plans to, you know, for example, I've got a lot of codes sitting unredeemed in my Casper suite at the moment. If I migrate my organization, none of those codes are going to work in the future. So unless I'm ready to move all my users over to managed distribution as well, it would be a mistake for me to request that migration right now, because I might want maybe tomorrow those kids to get some of those codes and redeem them for themselves. On the other hand, if there are apps where none of the set have been redeemed yet, I might want to actually take them out of Casper right now so that nobody redeems the codes and I can migrate them all in the future. It also says, if you use Apple Configurator for devices that are shared between employees or students, you may want to use redemption codes because managed distribution requires individual Apple IDs. Apple Configurator will continue to support distribution of apps through redemption code for shared or non-personalized devices. So if you're sticking with an institutional model or a shared lesson one-to-one model where you have iPads which are not personal to any particular individual, you're going to want to continue to use that Apple Configurator model, because with the managed distribution, what happens, as far as I understand it, is that every user of a device has their own Apple ID, and then what they do is they connect their Apple ID with your MDM server, and you can use that to assign. You're not assigning apps to devices anymore. What you're doing is you're assigning apps to Apple IDs, and then the user receives a copy of that. Now, on the page you mentioned earlier, Bradley, the apple.com/education/VPP, it tells you there is it says, for halfway down the page, it talks about flexible options, managed distribution, and then it talks about automatic install. And this is also something that is new with iOS 7 and supervised devices. And what this does, when you assign an app to an Apple ID is you can push the installation to a device, but instead of under iOS 6 and earlier, the user would see an alert saying the server wants to install an app. Do you say yes or no? It can just silently install the app on the individual's device. I think that's going to be really cool for school, because what it means is that if I know all the kids are in school, I can just push that out and all the devices will get the app, and they'll get it A, from my cache server, which is awesome, but B, they'll get it during the school day, so I know that everybody who was there that day got the app and the rest can get it later in the future.
You know, it seems like every year we get so much new, and we, as I always say, man, if you were doing your first initial rollout this year, it's going to be great. And in all the things we had last year that were great, if you were planning your first deployment for the fall, it'd be even easier.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's definitely, you know, these tools are getting put in place, and, you know, while some of them may have, shall we say, rough edges, I don't want to sound like a greybeard, but I remember the days when none of this existed, and those days were pretty rough too. So things are definitely improving, and I think I really look forward to using this managed distribution system, because I think that over time you can see a way in which every user in the school has their own Apple ID, regardless of their age. You know, whether that's possible now or not, you can see that that's a desirable goal in the future at some point, and it seems to me that that's something that could be solved. I guess the next thing we need our MDM vendors to ship support for this.
Poor guys. They've had iOS 7 to upgrade for, and now this.
Yeah, and of course all the new restriction features in iOS 7 to supervised devices as well. So, yeah, it's been a busy year for MDM vendors, but at the same time, they're looking at a much bigger market now, because they have the opportunity to, you know, everybody needs one of their products. You know, I don't think it's going to be tenable, certainly, to do a personal model one-to-one deployment, like for our senior school, without having a good MDM in place and having managed distribution and all that kind of stuff in place as well. Now, of course, we like Casper, because Casper likes us, or Jamf likes us, but I know that for a fact that there are other MDM vendors who are going to provide support for this in pretty short order as well. So, again, as with most things MDM, almost everybody can support all of the things. So I suspect that most of the names you know, Lightspeed, Casper, AirWatch, MobileIron, all of these companies will have support for this sooner or later. I haven't seen an announcement from Jamf yet about Casper, but I'm pretty sure they'll be... I mean, it wouldn't be Jamf if they weren't right up there for this stuff as well. So,
and this may be where the paid options like kind of really begin to set themselves apart from someone like Meraki's MDM that's free.
Yep.
Are they incentivized to implement all these awesome features quickly?
Yeah. That's going to be a big question, and this is the kind of thing where, you know, this is a testing time for a solution like Meraki, which is free. And is perfectly good, but how long will it be before Meraki has support for this? That is an interesting question. That tells you something about it. So, interesting times. I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be a really nice new way to scale up even bigger some of these things. Because the ideal always, right, is that you never want to see a device back in your hands, ever.
Right.
And I don't know exactly how this is going to play for our younger kids. I don't know that we necessarily want to give them their own Apple ID at age 6 and 7. But, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I think certainly there are kids in years below age 13 where they could perfectly competently manage an iOS device, because, let's face it, they already are managing their own iOS devices at home in many cases. So it's not... I don't think it's, you know, 13 years old is some kind of magical age where you suddenly become competent to manage your own iOS device. I mean, 13 years old is just a number made up by the government in America, right, with the Children's Online Privacy Act. So I think in future times, one can see possibly that being like some kind of rite of passage in the school. If you do a particular training course, you get a good enough grade, you can get your own Apple ID, you know, something like that, possibly. I'm just speaking off the top of my head there, but that's an interesting possibility for a way to approach who gets to run their own Apple ID, and who has to take something managed by the school. Could work.
Yes. I've got two interesting tidbits for you that you might care about. Somebody sent me a DM over Twitter that happened to pop up. Google Drive for iOS now supports multiple logins.
Yeah. Oh, so good.
Yeah. And there is an update for Mail that fixes the Gmail issues, apparently, on Mavericks.
Mail on Mavericks, yeah. I tried your recommendation of... I've just totally blanked on the name of that really cheap mail client for the Mac.
AirMailer,
right. I tried that. That's a pretty cool app.
Yeah, it's not bad. And like, it's $2 in the App Store, but like, if you go to their website, you can... They have kind of an ongoing beta version that you can test and use for free forever. But again, it's the beta version, yeah. So... I'm using the paid version. Yeah, I like it. Like, occasionally, it'll be a little wonky, but it's got some neat features. I really like the Dropbox and Droplr integration. Also has Google Drive integration where, like, you know, if it's a big attachment, it can automatically, like, upload it to an attachments folder that it creates in Dropbox, and then it just drops a link in there to the email automatically. Yeah, I know you can do that before, like, by right-clicking on a file and sharing, but I don't know. It's neat. I really think, and we should talk about that on another show, like, it's time to rethink mail on the Mac, especially.
Yeah, there have been sort of fits and starts of innovation back on the Mac with some of that stuff. Spiral for a while. I don't know if that's still going. They were acquired, weren't they?
Yeah, Google bought them. And I think it's like kind of... I think the development of the Mac one has pretty much ceased. I think it still works, but it's not getting any updates. I do think there was an update for the iOS version that kind of made it more iOS 7e. But yeah, it's I know it's tough. It's tough to make. It's kind of like EverPix, you know, the big shutdown. If you follow me on Twitter, you can see I've been crying. But it's those are hard products to make work financially. And you know, when what's the market for a paid mail client that's not built in? I mean, how many people can you realistically get?
Tricky, definitely tricky. Cool. I'm just looking at the Google Drive app, which, to be honest with you, I am amazed at the way that Google Drive has worked its way into my life in a way that I never even wanted it to. I mean, if you talked to me 2 years ago, I would say Google Docs sucks. Google Drive will be a joke compared to Dropbox. And, you know, go away. And today, I use Google Drive and Google Docs literally every day. You know, every single day at school, we're doing something in Google Drive, either with the kids or with the teachers. And the iOS app is brilliant in my mind. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, to have gone from where it was in its first iteration to what it is now, I think that is one of the most improved apps on iOS over the past year. And full credit to Google, and my apologies for being such a cynic in the early days, because I have just been delighted with it. I think it's a great service now, and strongly competitive to Dropbox, particularly in terms of the cost per gigabyte. When you're looking at the paid options, Google Drive is literally 50% of the cost of Dropbox at the same storage levels. Really interesting.
Yes. Yeah, it's you just wonder with Dropbox, like, why have they not either lower the price or raise their, like, the fact that the $100 plan still gets 100 gigabytes, like, years later, it seems like that should be 250 by now.
Yeah, you kind of feel like those limits should be getting higher, you know. But like, as with the EverPix thing, cloud storage ain't free. I mean, we did an exercise in the computing class not so long ago with the higher computing kids where, you know, I've done this exercise for years where I have them go and look at, like, you know, what's the biggest hard drive you can get? How much is that per gigabyte? What's the biggest SSD you can get? How much is that per gigabyte? And, you know, look at floppy disks, which are really expensive per gigabyte, and so on. And this year I actually had them include cloud storage in that. And obviously we know hard drives are cheap per gigabyte, SSDs are more, cloud storage is more again. And it was the first time I had done that exercise as well. And I was quite surprised to see sort of just how expensive cloud storage actually is per gigabyte compared to anything local. But obviously it has its advantages and there are reasons for it. But it was interesting that what came out of that we noticed was that Dropbox is twice the price of Google Drive. Particularly, you know, when you look at the Google Apps version where you get 30 gigs of drive space for free per user, it's it's a compelling product. What can I say? I love it.
Well, and I wonder if that also comes to the fact that Dropbox is using S3, so they're paying retail pricing for storage, where Google has wholesale pricing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's got to be a big factor in it as well. Speaking of S3 and Amazon, I got the bill for running our MDM server on EC2. Little more expensive on the medium version. So we paid about $130 this month on fees running Casper on EC2. We had to bump it up from the lowest tier, the micro tier, to the small tier. And there's a substantial step in cost at that point. So possibly, you know, we'll have to live with it this year, but I think maybe come the summer we'll migrate it back to a local machine and live with it that way over time, because that stuff adds up. You know, the cloud adds up for sure. But gotta love the cloud. And it certainly makes iPads, you know, vastly more powerful. I mean, if you think about the ability to use something like Dropbox or Google Drive as an offline or nearline storage service for your iPad, you know, you don't have to be a crazy person like me and buy a 128 gig drive. You can get a much smaller one if you have enough bandwidth to shuffle things on and off in a timely manner. Cool. So, interesting things this week. iPad Air, unbelievable. I'm so happy with it. And so excited to see where the kind of next level of productivity comes from. Caching Server 2 in Mavericks works a treat. Takes you 20 seconds to set up. Definitely worth it if you have a lot of iOS users on your network. And this whole managed distribution App Store volume purchase thing, keep your eyes on that for now, because that's going to be a big thing over the next year. Got anything else for this week, Bradley?
I think that's it. It's some exciting stuff. It's good ground level stuff.
Yeah, it's nice to see the basics moving forward a little bit. You know, cloud, the things on top, iOS and all of that. But if the device doesn't get faster, and interestingly, you know, if you look at the Geekbench numbers, iPads didn't get faster for a very long time. It was only a year ago and now that iPads were substantially faster than the original iPad.
Yes.
You know, and in some ways that Moore's Law curve took a bit of a dip between 2010 and 2012. And I think what you see now is with the fourth generation iPad, and now the iPad Air, we're really back onto Moore's Law curve again. And I think Apple's chip design team, who only really got started, their first product was the original iPad with the A4 chip. That was their first product. And obviously they took a little bit of time to find their feet and get the Retina stuff done. But now clearly they're getting into their stride, and the performance boost that we're seeing with A6 and then A7, really nice and bodes well for the future.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Gotta love Moore's Law.
Well, it does seem like the Retina thing kind of slowed them down a little bit, and having to get the, you know, if the devices, like if the iPad 4 wasn't Retina, how fast would it be?
Yeah. I mean, you got to remember, when the third generation iPad came out, people were just like blown away that they'd managed to make a Retina display that big. And today we're all like, well, why isn't everything Retina? Why isn't the iPad MacBook Air Retina already? Come on. But you have to remember what a kind of technical challenge that was back in early 2012 to put a Retina display in an iPad and build one that big. Because people were like, well, can they even do that? I'm not sure. And now, of course, we're kind of getting over that technical hurdle. And a lot of things are going Retina. You know, Nexus has got a Retina display. Kindle Fires have got Retina displays. All the iPads now. Retina is eating the world, and it'll be all the better for it. Shall we leave it there for this week?
I think so. Good week. Enjoy your iPads. Maybe I'll have mine soon.
Yeah, just try not to imagine such smooth multitasking.
My mini feels so old.
It is. Soon. It'll be here for Thanksgiving. Don't worry.
That's true. Yes, it will be.
Home for the holidays. Right, let's wrap it up. Let's remind people where they can find us. iTunes Store, reviews. Could you leave us a review for Thanksgiving? That would be lovely.
5-star, preferably. If you're going to do 1-star, then just please don't.
Yeah, just go and do something else if you're going to do a 1-star. Outofschool.net is our website. If you want to sponsor the show, get in touch. We're always looking for new sponsors to fill in future gaps. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web. Bradley, where can people find you?
Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web. Again, all the links we talked about and links to the sponsors will be at outofschool.net at the most recent show. That'll be at the top. And if you use anything but Apple's podcast app, you'll also have links inside of your app as well.
Yeah, and you can usually find the show in the search fields in most of those apps as well now.
I don't know how that works. Like, are they scraping the iTunes store? I don't know how that works. Are.
Unless there's some other third-party database that we don't know about, but I think that's where...
Well, see, I've never submitted our show to anything but iTunes, so like, it has to be the iTunes store.
I'm sure it must be. Okay, until next week.
All right, have a good week.